As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman. And Bruce, it's the first weekend of October coming up, and it's a heck of a slate of games in college football. There are so many important games. I was picking the 10 games for our picks column, and there were ones that any other week would be a no-brainer that I couldn't even fit in there. Which one are you most interested in?
Interested in a lot of them, to be honest. The thing that I would preface this by saying is some of the games that I'm most interested in about have some actually surprisingly big spreads. I'm curious. I think because Arkansas has been a revelation the first month of the season, now they're going on the road to Georgia. Arkansas is coming off what felt like a big game against A&M. The spread's 18.5. That is a big, that is a big number for anything involving a top 10 team that's not playing Alabama. Right. And I'm curious about that. We'll touch on these more in depth. I mean, to answer your question, I'm very curious to see how Michigan's offense does against what's the number one run defense in the country. Wisconsin's not been good at all on offense, but they have been able to stop the one thing Michigan has really lived on. So I don't want to say if Michigan wins this game on the road at Wisconsin that it checks the box and they're for real, but I think it's a test. And then to me, obviously have the Kiffin Saban matchup, but the one that I'm very interested in is Cincinnati's coming off a bye week. Notre Dame's coming off playing Wisconsin and blowing them out. Cincinnati's actually a 1.5-point favorite on the road against Notre Dame, who's undefeated. Are you surprised by the spread even?
I'm surprised it's not higher. Also, I'm surprised that this game is not getting more of a top billing. I understand that Georgia-Arkansas is also a top 10 game, and Arkansas is a hot story right now, and that's where game day is going. But we've been talking about the Cincinnati-Notre Dame game all offseason as the game that if Cincinnati wins, first if they beat Indiana, which they did, and then if Cincinnati beats Notre Dame, if they beat both those teams on the road, that low, we've suddenly got a path for our first ever group of five team to make the playoff. And now that it's here, before the season, I would say that's going to be an uphill task for the Bearcats. But I don't think people realize Notre Dame is 4-0 and they're in the top 10. And they had a very, what ended up being a lopsided win against Wisconsin, a little bit deceiving the final score. Bruce, do you know that Notre Dame is ranked 128th in the country in rushing, 128th out of 130 teams, 2.3 yards per carry, and 129th in, they've allowed 20 sacks more than any team in the country besides Akron. And they're going up against Cincinnati, who is known for their defense. Sell me on why Notre Dame can win this game.
Because they played in a lot more big games, to be honest.
So the idea that Cincinnati might just not might be selling you on by the
like,
stage.
I think Cincinnati's good. I know they have a lot of athletes, especially on defense. And I know Desmond Ridder, I think, is the better quarterback in this game. I will sell you why. Look, I'm picking Cincinnati to win the game just like you are. But I can see why there's some hesitance because, you know, we're basically giving Cincinnati a lot of juice off of last year. And the fact that they beat an Indiana team who, by the way, hasn't looked good this year. They got blown out at Iowa. They barely beat Western Kentucky. And they actually outgained Cincinnati in that game and seemed to be, you know, handling it pretty good until their best defensive player got a targeting call and that kind of changed the game. So I get why there is some hesitance on Cincinnati, you know, looking a little deeper into it. I think Cincinnati is good, but I think they're, you know, like I want to see how they do against, are they going to light up the Notre Dame defense? I mean, I'm not sure, you know, like I get why people are like, yeah, Notre Dame's offensive line has been uncharacteristically underwhelming. Their run game, as you said, and with the backs they have back, you know, Kyron Williams was a borderline All-American candidate. They have not got the run game going. They got a bunch of points in either the return game with Chris Tyree or on pick sixes last week. You know, I'm interested to see how this one plays out. Now, to me, a big factor here is Cincinnati is coming off a bye week. So they had an added week to really prepare and get ready for this. I don't know. I mean, would you be surprised if Notre Dame won this game by double digits?
By double digits?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it'd be so, like, you know, 27.
I'm not saying Notre Dame can't win. They're still a very good team playing in their home stadium. But yeah, I guess if they win by double digits, then it tells me that because you're right, in the Indiana game, Indiana basically dominated the first half and then Cincinnati took over in the second half. So if Notre Dame ends up winning big, it tells me that that first half was more indicative of Cincinnati 2021, that it wasn't just them brushing it off and pulling away in the second half. The way Notre Dame would win this game is probably much the way they beat Wisconsin. They would cause turnovers, maybe pick off Desmond Ridder a couple times, big plays in special teams, because they're not going to be able to, I don't think, sustain long touchdown drives with the lack of a running game. It's going to have to be hold Cincinnati down, chip away, get a pick six at some point, something like that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Before we get to the intrigue of Lane Kiffin trying to become the first Nick Saban protege in 24 tries to beat Alabama, I do want to get into that. But one of the other games that I think kind of is a sneaky, I don't know, sneaky good game, but is actually Friday night. It's Maryland, who is undefeated at 4-0, against Iowa, who's number 5 in the country.
That's my upset special.
Oh, okay. So I'm glad I brought this up. I know you've been a little skeptical of just how good Iowa is. I know you buy into their defense, I think. But so are you all in on the Terps? Do you think the Terps are a legit top 10 team?
It's more that I don't think that. And by the way, we were the first ones to say after those big wins against Indiana and Iowa State that Iowa deserved to have that really high ranking. But as we get further removed from it, and both of those teams they played have been disappointing. And then to see them in a one-score game against Colorado State well into the game, I don't have a lot of faith. Iowa's got to get their offense going. I mean, you can't expect that you're going to have two pick sixes every week or you know, all the turnovers they caused in those big games. And I thought, you know, Spencer Petras would be better. I thought their running game would be better. Right now, Iowa is 122nd in the country in yards per play. Would you have guessed that Talia Tagovailoa is the top-rated passer in the Big Ten?
He's got really good receivers. It doesn't shock me that he's got really good receivers, and he is talented.
He's completing 75% of his passes, 1,340 yards, 10 touchdowns, and one pick. Now, he's going against a really good defense. It would be surprising to me if he throws for like 350 yards. But they're going to score some points. And Iowa, to this point, has not demonstrated that they can do the same.
Yeah, I think a big question is going to be, can he avoid turnovers against them? I mean, I think really that's as much the deal as anything else. How well can they take care of the ball? Iowa just really, really bottles you up, and I think it gets frustrating for opponents. You look at them, they lead, or at least they're tied for the conference lead in interceptions. Actually, they do lead because Nebraska's played one more game. They both picked off six passes. But you look at what they're able to do. It's just such a problem for you. Phil Parker does not get enough credit for what he's doing with Iowa, and they have some really good players at all three levels of the defense. So gutsy pick. I wouldn't pick the upset, but I do think it's going to be a really interesting game tomorrow night.
You know what's crazy? Looking at this Big Ten passing rating. First of all, it tells you like there are not a lot of good quarterbacks in the Big Ten this year, but what's crazy is if you think about who were kind of the most, who had the highest expectations coming into the season, Michael Penix and Graham Mertz are the two lowest rated passers in the Big Ten. Tagovailoa, Sean Clifford, Peyton Thorne are 1, 2, 3, CJ Stroud 4, Adrian Martinez 5, and then on the opposite end, Penix and Graham Mertz.
Well, actually, that is interesting. You know, another name that's way down there, Tanner Morgan. 2 years ago, yep. Tanner Morgan was arguably the most improved quarterback in the country. They won 11 games, and he's thrown 3 touchdowns in 4 games and is completing under 53% of his passes.
In 2019, Tanner Morgan was the number 4 rated quarterback in the whole country. It was 1, Joe Burrow, 2, Jalen Hurts, 3, Justin Fields, 4, Tanner Morgan. And 2 years later, you know, I mean, look, that he had two phenomenal receivers on that team. And as those guys cycled out and there have been injuries this year, he's not looking remotely like himself. Okay, let's get to the game you mentioned, the Lane Kiffin, Alabama, Nick Saban Bowl. Last year's game, if you remember early in the season, 63-48, it was nobody could stop anybody. It seemed like Alabama wasn't prepared for Ole Miss's tempo. I think Ole Miss this year is probably an even better offense. Matt Corral's been there in the system for another year. We just don't know. Their defense was so terrible last year. We just don't know yet if they've gotten better enough to stop Alabama, to stop Bryce Young, who's been playing very well.
Yeah, and I think I don't think they have to stop him. I just think they have to be able to slow somebody down, because I don't think they'll be able to stop Bryce Young in the offense, and he has a really good offensive line. I was curious. I haven't seen anybody. This is a big spread. I think it started out at 20. It's around 2 touchdowns now. I was expecting somebody I know to go, I'm picking Ole Miss. Like, I think there are some – I talked to some coaches in the SEC who are like, think Lane Kiffin has a better chance to pull this upset off more than a lot of sports writers do. I think they watched the Alabama-Florida game and thought Alabama was much more flawed than people probably felt like they were. They looked like they were gassed late in the game. They didn't look kind of like what people would expect. And I think because their offense was so good last year – I don't think this, I think this offense is good. I don't think it's quite to the level of what you had. You know, you had Devontae Smith at one point, you had Jalen Waddle in there, you had Najee Harris, you had the best offensive line in college football. I don't know if it's quite at that level. Like, I would not, which would you be more surprised about? Arkansas going into to Georgia and beating them, or Ole Miss beating Alabama?
I would be less surprised about Ole Miss beating Alabama. I certainly considered picking it. My hesitation, first of all, I think this will be, if Alabama is going to lose a game in the SEC this year, it would be this one. It's just such a different kind of matchup. But my hesitation is simply this. You know Saban has had, you know, he probably assigned one or two analysts who spent the last 12 months studying Ole Miss and Lane Kiffin exclusively. He is not going to let his former assistant, his brash former assistant, embarrass his defense again. That's my only hesitation. I think if last year's game had not been the way it was, maybe he comes out. It's better for them, you know, better circumstances for them to pull a surprise here. Now, I do think, I think whichever quarterback wins this game will come out of it the new Heisman favorite, and it's a chance for Matt Corral to really show the country why he's now kind of the hot, trendy NFL draft quarterback. But we do know he's interception prone, or at least he has been in the past, and that's a defense that can do that.
Yeah, towards that end, he had threw a 14 picks last year. 13 of them came in three games, and 11 of them came in two. So when he's been off, he has really been off, and I think that's the issue is when something bad happens in the game, when something bad happens in the game, how does he respond to it? And that will be interesting because, you know, our buddy Andy Staples did a really good job of writing about Matt Corral this week. That's the best story I've read on Matt Corral. Not to say there's been a bunch of them. There's been a lot of good stories. But I thought what really came true was just a total, like a Favre-like belief in his skill set and sometimes forcing balls and maybe to be an ultra aggressive in it. And we'll see how that plays out. I'm interested. Now, by the way, the thing you said about Saban and designated a couple of analysts to study Ole Miss's offense for the last year, I mean, that was the case with Johnny Manziel when Johnny Manziel beat him the first time. Johnny Manziel torched him even worse the second time. They didn't win the game, but he was like 600 yards of offense against them.
I remember, it was a long time ago, but I remember the narrative leading up to that one was, Saban's going to have all sorts of wrinkles ready. There's no way he's going to be able to do that again. And it was basically just like whoever scores last.
Now, what was different on that, and I don't know if we're going to get this part of it, was Mike Evans was the go-to guy. And they, because I was with A&M the week of that game, they were like, they're not stopping Mike Evans. They targeted one of the cornerbacks by like a half hour into the game. That guy was like on the sideline and, you know, well, he kind of excommunicated essentially. But I think, you know, I'm very fascinated. Nothing would surprise me in this game. It also wouldn't surprise me if Alabama's up 24-3, you know, at halftime too.
Yeah, that's a very wide range of possibilities. The Arkansas-Georgia game, I think that spread is very high. And while I did pick Georgia, although this was now the third time I'm picking against Arkansas, so maybe they'll make me look dumb again. Are we sure Georgia is this? I mean, that's the kind of spread that I'm used to seeing, you know, Alabama get when they remember when Alabama would play like a highly ranked Texas A&M team and still be favored by 22. That's what this looks like to me. And I don't think Georgia's really been tested yet. We thought they were in the first game, but now we know that Clemson's offense is just a complete mess. And then since then, they've been beating up on the likes of UAB, South Carolina, and Vanderbilt. So I'm just really interested to see KJ Jefferson, dual threat quarterback. Will the Georgia defense look a little less, you know, right now they've been unbelievable. They've been dominant every week. Will that will Arkansas be able to maybe expose them a little bit, especially that secondary that was a big question coming into the season, in a way they haven't been yet?
Now, Georgia is expected to get Tyke Smith, who's probably one of their best defensive backs. He was the safety who transferred from West Virginia in. He's missed the first month of the season. I think that would certainly help. I wondered about how much, Sam Pittman's knowledge of Kirby Smart and Georgia, obviously he worked there, how much that would help him in this game. They played last year. It wasn't close. It was at Arkansas. It was 37-10. That was obviously his first game. The one thing is, it was like wasn't like Georgia ran it down their throats. I think it was 120 rushing yards for them. So it was really the fact that they couldn't get much going offensively, and it was all kind of over before it started. So yeah, I'm definitely want to see, like, if Arkansas loses this game, like 31-13, I don't think it undoes a lot of the confidence, like the kind of belief that we now have in Sam Pittman and Arkansas. But man, if they, this is a big if, but if Arkansas were to win this game, I think Arkansas would deserve to be in the top three at that point. If not,
you know what it reminds me of? The year Mississippi State and Dak Prescott kind of came out of nowhere. I remember in like a 3-week span, they beat a top 10 LSU team very handily on the road, came back and beat a top 10 A&M team that would turn out to be very overrated, but they were top 10 at the time. And then I was there for number 2 Auburn versus number 3 Mississippi State in Starkville. And once they won that, they were number 1. This would be kind of similar. I don't think they'd move to number 1, but my goodness, like, you'd have to, if they beat Georgia, to me, they're a national title contender, which seems very hard to believe given where that program was 2 years ago. But that's, how could you not say that?
I would hope, if that's the case for Sam Pittman and Arkansas, that they finish the year a lot better than that Mississippi State team did, because they didn't even end up in the top 10.
So. Is that right?
Yeah.
I remember they lost to...
They got blown out by Georgia Tech in the bowl game, and they finished 12.
They played Alabama. It's kind of hard to believe this now, but I also covered that this year. That year, it was like early November, Mississippi State at Alabama, and Mississippi State went into that game number 1, not Alabama. Alabama handled them. I think they then lost the Egg Bowl, too.
They lost the Egg Bowl by, like, a Freeze beat them. I think they lost the Egg Bowl by 2 or 3 touchdowns.
I mean, I think the reason Arkansas is such a big underdog is that you generally expect these teams that, I mean, Arkansas recruits well. They don't recruit like Alabama and Georgia. And you just kind of assume they'll regress to the mean at some point, whether that's this week or later in the season. But I don't want to rain on that parade now. We got some mailbag questions to get to. Give me one more game. Give me one more game that you're like, would not be surprised if the underdog pulls it off.
I would not be surprised if Michigan beat Wisconsin.
Can we really count that? That's a 1.5 okay. point spread.
Hang on a second.
I'll give you some options. Texas TCU, LSU Auburn, Florida 8.5 at Kentucky, Oklahoma 10.5 at K-State.
You already hit one for me. I will take LSU Auburn. LSU is a 3.5 point favorite. Auburn has maybe the most talented running back in the country in Tank Bigsby. I think they can run the ball. I don't think LSU can. LSU's offensive line has been really, really patchwork. I mean, you got to remember, they have a new offensive line coach who got there after spring ball. He got there in the summer. So you got guys trying to learn different techniques, new techniques. You have a bunch of injuries up front, and now you have them going up against the team that leads the SEC and TFLs. I think this is going to be a real scuffle. I know that Max Johnson is playing well. I know that he's got some really good receivers. I think if LSU can't get some run game going, I think they're going to have a hard time beating Auburn. I really do, just because I think Auburn has a really big time running back, and I think that's going to cause. I think that will present some challenges for them.
I'm going to give you a little bit of an upset alert game that was that didn't even make our list of games we picked this week, and it's the one taking place in my backyard. Stanford, 8-point underdog against Oregon.
By the way, I did pick that game.
What's that?
I did pick that game.
Oh, you did? What'd you do?
I took Oregon to cover and then some.
To cover. And maybe they'll blow them out by 3 touchdowns. I don't know. But Oregon hasn't played that well outside of that Ohio State game. That Arizona game, and Arizona is terrible, was a close game in the fourth quarter. Stanford, 2-2, definitely mediocre, definitely bad on defense.
The worst run defense in the Pac-12.
But Tanner McKee has quietly been really impressive since he took over as the starting quarterback in week two. And we saw, they did win at Ohio State, but we saw C.J. Stroud throw for a bunch of yards on them. I will say, if Kayvon Thibodeau really does come back this week, I'll take that off the upset board probably. But just something to keep an eye on. I think Oregon is a really good team. I still have them going to the playoff. I don't expect them to run the table in the Pac-12. They're going to stub their toe at some point. I'm surprised you didn't go with BC at Clemson.
I thought about it. That's a 15-point spread. I think Jeff Hafley's done a terrific job. He's now playing with his backup quarterback. I thought about it pretty hard, and then I was like, they just had this huge emotionally draining overtime win. I just wonder about kind of an adrenaline dump for them to get back up. Clemson, our colleague Grace Rayner and I spent a bunch of time working on this story about what exactly is wrong with the Clemson offense, and also what can they do to try to fix it at this point. And I don't feel very confident in Clemson at this point. I feel like Clemson's probably headed to 8-4-ish or 9-3. Wow. And that's in a really, really bad ACC. But I think that's just kind of right now where Clemson's at offensively.
I highly recommend people read that story that you and Grace did on The Athletic. And if you're not a subscriber, theathletic.com/theaudible for 50% off. So I think it's very easy from a distance to say, oh, well, they lost Trevor Lawrence and Travis Etienne. Of course, they're not as good anymore. I did not, they've spent the last few years just rolling people. I never stopped to be like, huh, I wonder if their offense has become too predictable. You guys have some quotes from analysts and opposing coaches, but also some pretty eye-opening advanced stats. And shout out to our guy Jason Sterrett, who does such a great job mining some of our data sources to find this stuff. It just never occurred to me that Clemson's offensive scheme is so simple. And when you have Trevor Lawrence and Travis Etienne, you can maybe you don't need much of a scheme. But there's a stat in that story that just blew me away about how little opponents respect the run. How little opponents respect Clemson's running game this year without Travis Etienne, which is this. Opponents used 5 or more defensive backs on 59% of Clemson snaps last season, but are using 5 or more defensive backs 99% of Clemson snaps this season. The play action pass won't be effective until defenses respect Clemson's run game, which currently ranks number 99 nationally. These teams like NC State are going out there and saying, go ahead, run the ball, try. And they can't do it. And they're Clemson. It's crazy.
Yeah, one of the things that I heard from one of the coaches in the conference was they just, not only was Travis Etienne one of the best backs in the history of the ACC, but I think they look at, Will Shipley came in, he was a huge recruit. There are coaches in the league who feel like they didn't think he was the guy who scared them the most. They thought Lynn J. Dixon, who's no longer in the program, was actually a more dangerous running back for them to deal with. And they just feel like there's just not a lot of wattage in the backfield at this point. And by the way, Will Shipley's injured and probably out for about a month now. The offensive line is not good. It has not been physical. And then you can get into, as you said in our story, there's a lot from both Dan Orlovsky and RG3 Robert Griffin, who had called for ESPN the last two games about what they saw, why the offense, as RG3 put it, was archaic. And they're just not giving the quarterback as well as the receivers a lot of flexibility to get guys open and to get a read on what defenses are doing. Orlovsky went so far, and this is something I heard from some NFL assistant coaches last year when they evaluated Trevor Lawrence. He echoed this week some of the comments that I heard on that was the scheme that they run. They thought it was pretty limited and didn't help him development wise. Now look, he was still the first pick in the draft, but he is definitely struggling in a big way in the NFL in terms of some of the reads and some of the things that are quite honestly seem to be really new to him. And so I think there's a lot of layers to that. And again, I don't think Clemson's going to all of a sudden like fall apart and won't win another, won't be a playoff team ever again. I don't think it's the case. But they have got to do what appears to be some adjusting in terms of how they call it and what they can do, especially for DJ Uiagalelei, who has a big arm and is a big physical guy. But, you know, you may see him having to shoulder more of the run game on himself if they're just going to, he's right now their second leading rusher, by the way. And he's the leading rusher of the guys available to them. So I'm interested to see what Jeff Hafley, how he tries to attack them. To me, what happened to Clemson, and I'm not saying this to necessarily prop up the story Grace and I did, but I think what has happened to Clemson is actually the biggest story of the first month of this season.
Yeah, I mean, they're just last year when they lost at Notre Dame, it was the first time they'd lost a regular season game in 3 years. So to go from that to you saying you think they're going to go 8-4 is stunning. It's absolutely stunning. We thought Dabo had just a machine going there. So, you know, they have time to get better, I suppose. But that story raised concern in terms of, okay, we know the offensive line's struggling. We know, I don't want me to keep talking about this, but it is really interesting. Travis Etienne, I think, was so underappreciated because of the way they would use him in the pass game and on screens. And you think about, okay, how did DJ go from throwing for the most yards and of any quarterback ever to play at Notre Dame Stadium to just looking helpless out there? I think that was a heck of a security blanket to have, where if you needed to check down, you could check down to Travis Etienne and he might break that thing anytime he touched the ball. And they just don't have that now. And you've got a quote in there from an assistant saying, yeah, basically every time it's second down, they throw a screen. I think it's time for Tony Elliott, the $2 million offensive coordinator, to reevaluate what he does.
One more stat on this, Stu, that I think is just eye-opening. If you look at big plays, which most teams define as 20-plus, Clemson is not only last in the ACC with 11 through 4 games, they have almost a fourth of what Virginia has. That's crazy to me because nobody looks at UVA and go, oh yeah, that is like the most explosive offense in college football. Virginia has almost four times as many 20-yard plays as Clemson does.
Well, I've had some people tell me they think that what Virginia is doing on offense right now, and look, they've got their butts kicked the last 2 weeks, say what you would, but like, is very innovative. They're doing a lot of really innovative stuff on offense. And based on your story, Clemson is doing the opposite.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Mailbag time. As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We talked about that Cincinnati Notre Dame game a little bit. Let's talk about the implications. Jane Dapkus, Stu and Bruce. Here's a fun problem to think about. What would you have to believe for Cincinnati to make it to the college football playoff? Obviously, they need to win in South Bend on Saturday and then win out. Beyond that, I suspect they need some help by the way of conference chaos in at least two, maybe three of the Power Five conferences, and probably some key wins by opponents on their schedule to help their strength of schedule. All right, let's take it from there. What's their path to the playoff if they win this game?
Okay, so let's start with this, the low-hanging fruit on this. Yes, they need to win out. I think they really can't afford Notre Dame to lose more than one other game. If Notre Dame is 9-3, we already know Indiana's not going to be a quality win for anybody because Indiana's sitting at 2-2. We suspect Indiana's probably going to be lucky to finish 7-5. So if Notre Dame doesn't end up, you know, holding up their end, I think they're going to have really a huge uphill battle. Now, what helps them, save, you know, sorry, Wake Forest and BC fans, but I don't think they're running the table. I think the ACC being so bad, at least that's one out of the picture, because normally Clemson was getting one spot. Now that Clemson is definitely not getting one spot. So now we're looking at the Big Ten, which I think could beat each other up pretty good. But to me, and I don't want to go through all this, the possible scenarios just a month into the season, but I think they're going, if you're Cincinnati, you are going to need SMU to keep winning, but you're also going to and stay undefeated till you meet them. But I think almost any conference, like if there's a one-loss SEC champ and they win the SEC, they're going to be ranked ahead of Cincinnati. If there's a one-loss Big Ten champ, there's probably a good chance that they're going to be ranked ahead of Cincinnati. Where I don't know is if Oregon loses one game and ends up 12-1 with a win at Ohio State, I don't know if Oregon if they lose, then they're going to fall down, but will they spring back up to leapfrog them? And I don't feel that confident in the Big 12 because look how Oklahoma has looked and people are kind of off the bandwagon now on them. So to me, I think you're going to need, you can't afford a, you know, somebody in the Big 12 or the Pac-12 running the table. But if they don't, then I think you have a pretty good chance, assuming Notre Dame holds up its end. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think things have been breaking pretty much as well as they possibly could.
Except for the Indiana part.
Except for the Indiana part. But in terms of, it looks like the ACC probably won't have a legit contender. That's one off the table. You probably need another Power Five champ to have two losses. Also, yeah, Indiana's not looking good, but SMU just went and beat TCU because they also need, I would say, at least one of the AAC teams, the team that they'll end up playing in the conference championship game, to be
top 15,
like a top 15, yeah, top 20 kind of team. So I mean, look, let's see how they look. I mean, first they have to win this game, and I hate to say it, but they probably need to win it a little bit decisively, put some style points on the board. I just think, you know, this at least as of now, looking like it's not going to be quite as top heavy a season, does bode well for the Bearcats.
Right now, give me the percentage chance that they go to the playoff.
I mean, do you really have to ask that before the Notre Dame game?
I have to.
Let's revisit it after.
You're saying they're going to beat them handily anyway, so just pretend that they do. So give me the percentage.
I mean, right now, it's hard to say more than like 10%.
Okay. Jeez, Stu.
Let's see how things keep breaking for
me. I kind of hate when I ask you something like this and our number is actually like, I would have said 13%. Yeah.
James in Los Angeles. Hey, guys. In Bruce and Antonio's story on USC last week, they quoted an assistant coach saying, quote, "There's probably 20 kids a year, maybe 30, that are getting paid big money to play college football. And this was before NIL and will constitute program debilitating punishments if discovered. I've heard others in the media, like Brock Huer, discuss this paying of players cheating as if it's common knowledge. What's the deal? If it was discovered that Alabama paid Tua $200,000 to commit to Alabama, they would vacate all of their wins for 3 years and be ineligible for any bowl games for 3 to 5 years. It wouldn't be quite that. Saban and his staff would be fired, da da da. If everybody knows about this, why haven't any real accusations occurred? What do you guys know? James in Los Angeles."
Here's where I would start. The key words in James is question, or there's four words. If it was discovered. The hard part of this is actually proving a bunch of stuff. You have to go back. A lot of our listeners probably don't even know this name. I know you remember it. Albert Means. Albert Means was one of the biggest recruits in the country, like figuratively and literally, a 340-pound defensive lineman, who basically was kind of auctioned off as part. One of the high school coaches was really aggrieved by this, and that's how stuff comes out. You need somebody. Like, I can't tell you how many allegations and things I've heard from coaches who have recruited guys. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard from coaches who have talked to high school coaches and then have told me a story. The hard part of that is, where does that go where somebody it can be substantiated? It's really, really hard. I mean, the Miami stuff that Charles Robinson and Yahoo wrote about, what you had was somebody in the middle. It's rare to get a booster to turn on his school, but that's what was going on. You had a really oddball guy in there in Nevin Shapiro, and that's how a lot of that came to light. But it just doesn't happen. The Reggie Bush stuff happened with USC because there was a runner or handler who was pissed off.
There's always, whenever those scandals happen, is always there's always an aggrieved party.
If you have
you need somebody to be aggrieved so much so that they're willing to go to the media.
If you have a player's family getting money, getting jobs, it's just one of those things that is hard for people to get held to the fire on. And so, I mean, like I looked into some stuff when I was working on Meat Market of things I had heard, and it just, it's hard to get it in print. You can't just, like, it's not a message board where you can just throw something out and there it is, you know? And I think the stuff that people are more likely to get into trouble for is usually, you know, this somebody got merchandise or something that's like much more like most kids who are of the, you know, like of that caliber of game-changing program, you know, stuff, they didn't make their decision because somebody gave their family a bunch of free gear. That's not what is probably a deciding factor on that. So it's, I don't know, it's always been murky, and it's one of those things where you hear about a ton if you talk to a lot of coaches and you talk to a lot of people around the country, and it's just part of the, I think it's just part of the this kind of business.
If anybody out there listening right now has proof, and I mean hard proof, that a college player got paid, email the audiblepod@gmail.com. But if it's just like, hey, my brother's barber said that he heard that such and such recruit got, you know, 100K to go play, not much we can do with that.
Stu, this question from Evan Nelson, big fan of the pod. Thank you, Evan. Looking across the coaching carousel of college football and how poorly so many hires have gone, I've begun to wonder how important head coaching experience actually is for Power 5 candidates. At least group of five coaches moving up. At least group of five coaches. If you look at the hires, it seems by the eye test, the better way to go is hire an assistant who has to build a staff from the ground up versus a group of five coach who brings in all of his group of five coordinators and position coaches. If you were FSU, Tennessee, Auburn, or Nebraska, would you rather an established coach from a lesser job or a coordinator to position coach that has enough good relationships to pull in a quality staff? Stu, what do you think?
I think Evan brings up a really good, an interesting thing here that doesn't often get discussed. Because, right, you see a Tom Herman, you see a Scott Frost, like, how did this go so badly? They won at such a high level at the group of five program. And then meanwhile, Sam Pittman, career assistant coach, goes into Arkansas and has the success he's having. I do think that's a valid point about these group of five coaches. When they get the head coaching job, they feel loyal to their assistants who helped them get the job. And they, I mean, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Scott Frost basically brought his entire UCF staff to Nebraska. And, well, wait a minute, this is different now. This is a different level of recruiting. It would really help if you had some guys on your staff who have recruited in the Big Ten or recruited in the SEC or the Big 12 or whatever. So, yeah, that's a tough spot. Like, it's not often that a coach gets a job somewhere and then just says, you know, thanks for your help, guys. I'm going to get completely different. Can you think of a?
I can.
Yeah.
Urban Meyer went from Bowling Green to Utah to Florida. He had his core group of guys. They won national titles. And I'm not dismissing what.
Oh, I was asking the opposite.
Oh, I'm
Can
sorry.
Can you think of one where a guy got a job and then just didn't bring anybody?
Yeah, Nick Saban went from Michigan State, albeit not a group.
That is a famous one because I don't know if it's urban legend, but the story is that he sent a plane back to East Lansing to pick up the assistants and none of them got on it.
Yeah. Look, Matt Campbell went from Group of Five to Iowa State, took most of his guys. That has worked out really well. I mean, so there are definitely examples. I don't want to say, you know, and Vanderbilt's not a Group of Five, but it's certainly not. It's on the bottom end of the food chain of the SEC. James Franklin took a bunch of those dudes to Penn State. It's worked out really well.
So let's say somebody, a USC, a Nebraska, I don't know, doesn't matter, hires Jamie Chadwell from Coastal Carolina.
This is the good example. Go on, and I'm going to fill something in with you on this specific one.
Would you maybe recommend to Jamie Chadwell, hey, bring a couple of your guys, you know, the guys you can't live without, but maybe hire some assistants you haven't worked with before, but who like keep Dante Williams. He's a great Pac-12 recruiter. You know, like you're going to need some guys who've been there before.
So from my understanding with Jamie Chadwell, who had a great year last year at Coastal Carolina, people, at least a lot of college coaches, very intrigued by his offense. He does not have Power 5, any experience of working in a Power 5, nor does most of his staff. They're all kind of outsiders in that regard. I don't think he wanted to. I think that was a concern for some of the SEC jobs that were looking at him, South Carolina, Tennessee, where you'd think, man, if I not to speak for you, but I think if those places hired him, I'd be like, ooh, that's a big hire for them. But there was hesitance about the experience from a Power 5 recruiting at that kind of place. Now, the flip side of this is I'm glad you gave the example you gave. You know, if you're going to be the head coach at USC, I'm not sure you want to be told you got to hire this guy on your staff. Because by the way, look at this, and I'm not saying this is how Dante Williams is thinking right now, but I know it as it relates to the Oregon head coaching job. Poorly kept secret. Mario Cristobal was not exactly the biggest fan of Jim Leavitt. You know, when Jim Leavitt was, a lot of people, Jim Leavitt probably thought he should have gotten the job when Willie Taggart left. And that became a very, very frosty relationship. Whoever does not, especially if you're the interim. Now, look, if Dante Williams goes 6-4 over these 10 games, which is probably feels kind of realistic, I don't think Dante Williams can expect he really will get serious consideration for the job. But the fact that you have a guy there who will have a lot of relationships with a lot of people, if Dante Williams is still on the staff and it's a new guy and he's being told, yeah, we're not telling you what to do, we're not telling you have to keep him, but you know, there's some kind of implication. We'd really like you to do that. That can become a problematic dynamic in the locker room, especially for a head coach. Head coaches don't want to be told, "Hey, we really think you should keep this guy or hire this person." You know, if I'm the head coach at USC, if you're hiring me, I don't want the AD or somebody in the athletic department to dictate that. Like USC already has enough challenges without that piece of it.
I agree. I think a good way to not get the coach to come is to dictate to them who they can hire. I think it's more, you know, you would want him to come to that realization on his own that, hey, I'm going to need some guys with experience. It's just a different, recruiting alone is completely different at that level, but so is just running a program at that level. Speaking of USC, our last one comes from Blaine from Virginia, frequent submitter of questions. Bruce and Stu, we've always wondered what the air raid would look like with elite talent. We have our answer with USC. It really exposed USC on the defensive side of the ball since they had no experience practicing against tight ends. Oregon State rammed it down their throat with two tight end sets all night. And it's a victim of its own success. Everyone borrows from it now, so everyone recruits smaller, quicker linebackers to defend it. What do you think? Is this the death of the air raid?
I don't think it is. I think that, look, Lincoln Riley is an air raid guy, except he has a really good run game offensive line guy in Bill Beedenbow, and they have brought a level of physicality to it. Whereas I think there's variations of the air raid. Dana Holgorsen kind of deviated from it a lot and would get wildly creative, but he would do a bunch of different stuff. Lincoln, I think, has his own spin on it. Mike Leach, I hate to use this term, but it's the one that's into my head so much whenever I think of it, is like, he's the uncut Coke. Like, he is not, like, that's the air raid. And when people look at how much they run the football, you go back when, God, I'm blanking on this kid. He used to look like Leach's son. God, the quarterback from Spokane. Connor Halliday, sorry. So Connor Halliday, he wanted to, like, that's why they were throwing it 85 times a game sometimes. Connor Halliday, he wasn't four-man box. Hey, I'm going to chuck it. And a lot of it is really on the quarterback. How much do they want to run? How much do they want to throw? What are they checking to? And I think in the case now, you have Graham, who is obviously a great quarterback in the area, Graham Harrell. I think that, look, they went all in on that philosophy, and the thing I would say with the air raid, and this is something that our friend John Wilner, I remember writing about a long time ago with Sonny Dykes, and pointed out that no one had won an air raid, no one had won a national title with an air raid, and that is true. The thing with of it is, though, the air raid will get you, I believe, if you have guys who really know how to run it and you can, you know, recruit and develop, the air raid will get you to 8 or 9 wins. I don't know if the air raid, you can win a national title strictly living off it. But, you know, if you're Cal, or you're a program like that where you're probably not winning a national title anyway, and you are mired in, you know, 3, 4, 5 wins, it could be a very good thing because it will give you an identity. The question is, if you're USC, is that something you need to do? And I think, like I said, it to me, it varies on how you approach it. With Lincoln Riley, I don't think, you know, I think it's workable. The issue is going to be on the defensive side of the ball. It feels like they've upgraded talent on the defense. Now they need the offense to kind of hold up its end. But to me, I just think it's like how committed you are to it and what you do with it. But I don't think it's the end of it by any stretch.
Great questions this week. Please send some more to the audiblepod@gmail.com. We've been answering them in our second episodes of the week. It's going to be a great Saturday. I have a feeling we're going to have a lot to talk about on Sunday morning's episode. We'll see you next time.